This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Peter Monmouth is a professor of history at Flinders University and the author of Captured Lives, Australia's Wartime Internment Camps. Good morning, Peter.
Morning. How are you going?
Good, thanks, Pete. Pete, can you just tell us, with the internment camps in Australia, I presume they started around World War One, and what were the circumstances?
That's right. The first ones were First World War, and they were to detain people who were considered security risks of one kind or another. So often they were people who were, in the language of the day, so-called enemy aliens. They came from one of the countries with which Australia was at war. So a percentage of them, not all of them, but a percentage of them were put in these detention camps. In the First World War, it was just men, mainly young men, very often men of military age. And then history repeated itself in the Second World War, whereby there was a different set of people, because in the Second World War, Australia was at war again with Germany, but also with Japan and with Italy. So they were the main countries of origin of the so-called enemy aliens who were put in internment camps.
Let's go back to the first one. How did they make that decision, though, of whether or not a person was considered to be, number one, dangerous? So do they have to be considered dangerous, or they just round up everyone with that nationality?
They didn't round up everyone. In many cases, the question of who was dangerous was answered by officials on the spot. There was legislation introduced quite early in the war that provided those powers to detain, and the first group that they were interested in was the group of people who would otherwise, had they been allowed to return to their homeland, would have presumably enlisted in enemy forces and therefore potentially could have been fighting against Australian forces in the war. That was the first group. Sometimes, for example, among the first people who were interned were men on German vessels, or they mightn't even have been German vessels. They might have been vessels that just happened to be in Australian ports at the time that the war broke out. And if they were army reservists, so they'd done some military training in Germany, they were young men, they would have been recruited had they returned home, then they were the sort of people who were detained in Australia. But then as time went by, the net widened, and there were other categories of people. There were people who might have been living in Australia for a long time, but against whom some kind of suspicions were raised, and so they could find themselves behind barbed wires. In time, there were even people who were naturalised, that is, that they had become Australians, in effect, in a formal sense, and even a few who were Australian-born. So as time went by, there were more and more who found themselves in that situation where they could be put in one of the internment camps.
So if you had a neighbour that was German and you didn't particularly like him, you could say, I think that they could be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it seems there were cases like that. There were certainly cases where people were interned for no good reason, really. There were suspicions. There was a general wartime atmosphere of distrust of Germans in particular, not just Germans in the First World War, people from Austria-Hungary as well, small number of Turks. Yes, that does seem to have been the case, that people might even have used that wider atmosphere for their own benefit. So, for example, to eliminate some kind of commercial rival, that was another set of circumstances where somebody might have been put in an internment camp for no genuine security reason.
Peter, we'll go to Second World War in a minute, but for the First World War, were there different degrees? Because as we see in prisons, there are different security risks. Were there different security assessments of different camps?
Not formal assessments, but the camps did vary. In the First World War, the first camps established were pretty crude in a number of ways. There was a camp here in South Australia called Torrens Island, and like a lot of the early camps, the accommodation there was tented. It was on an island, and that made it difficult to escape. In fact, in the First World War, a number of the camps were located on islands. There was one on Rottnest Island in WA, Bruny Island in Tassie. And as time went by, though, they took some steps to consolidate the system, and so they built a big camp in Liverpool in Western Sydney. That was the Holsworthy camp, and that was certainly high security, but standards were better for the internees there. Against that, they had a camp at Trial Bay near Kempsey, which was for more privileged internees, and there was an old jail there that was used. But the internees were able to spend time on a peninsula there adjacent to the camp. And they were relatively well looked after. There are even, there's a photograph I'm aware of internees playing tennis. So these were relatively comfortable circumstances compared with Holsworthy.
Why did those people get an exception and were treated differently?
Yeah, pretty much in line with the standards of the time. They tended to be wealthier people, people of business backgrounds, honorary consuls. That was, and in other cases too, some of the prisoners were prisoners of war. That is, you know, that they were interned because they had been fighting. It was quite a rare thing, but for example, the crew of the Emden, a German warship, were put into camps in Australia, and there was always a strict division between officers and ratings or other ranks in those circumstances. So in the standards of the time, that was considered appropriate, that you wouldn't detain officers together with their men. There'd be that kind of social separation, so that the camps, in a sense, replicated the world outside the camps.
We'll go to calls in a minute. Just firstly, was there much of a difference between the camps in the First War and the Second War?
Yeah, I would say the big difference was in the First World War, both POWs and internees were put into camps, and they were called prisoner of war camps, or even, strangely enough, it might seem commonly in the First World War, they were called German concentration camps. That was the language of the time, that this idea of concentration camps had come from the Boer War. In the Second World War, Australia, like many other powers, made a clear distinction between civilian internees and prisoners of war. And they weren't kept together. Sometimes particular camps were used for the same purpose, but not at the same time. So, for example, Hay in New South Wales, that was for a time a POW camp, and for a time also a camp for civilian internees. And some of those Second World War camps were much bigger as well. They were quite austere, but probably offered a superior standard of accommodation to the more makeshift ones, which sprang up in the course of the First World War.
Peter, I know that because we had a big intake of Italians coming into Australia after the Second World War, but there were still quite a few Italians before the Second World War, or during the Second World War. Where did most of the people come from that were in these camps? Because you spoke about Germany and Italy. What were the other countries that we saw large populations?
Yeah, well, Italy was the biggest group, so quite a lot of Italian civilian internees, but then also large numbers of Italian POWs. So they were men who were captured often by Australian forces in North Africa. And a lot of those were brought to Australia. And one of the interesting things in the case of the Italians was that there were large numbers of Italians who were brought to Australia then after the armistice, so Italy swapped sides, so to speak, in September 1943. So even when Italy formally wasn't at war with Australia, Australia was taking more Italian POWs. A lot of them in the meantime had been in India. And the situation in Australia was that Australians needed labour. They wanted people working on farms in particular. So the Italians were thought of as appropriate farm labourers, and many of them, by their thousands, they were sent on work detachments to Australian farms and other places of work.
Hey, Peter, after Italy decided to, as you say, swap sides, were they then set free? Were they allowed out?
No, so the arrangement normally, according to international law, once the war was over, then you had this obligation to return POWs to their country of origin. But it was recognised that, in effect, the war was still going on. In effect, there was a civil war going on in Italy. There was no possibility of sending them home safely to Italy. After the war, after 1945, of course, they did have to send them home, even if some of them didn't want to. But in that period, 43 to 45, the agreement was reached that they would remain prisoners of war. They would still be treated as prisoners of war, but in very large numbers of cases, by their thousands, they were deployed in that way in Australia, much to the advantage of Australians. But it was probably a good thing for those men as well, not to be sitting around doing nothing, which was the curse of many POWs, but also civilian internees, but allowed the freedom to go and live on farms, and in many cases they weren't supervised. There were POW control centres around the country, but after a time people recognised that the Italians, by and large, they weren't going to want to escape anyway. I mean, if you escaped from an Australian farm, where would you go?
Yes, true. You're probably better off staying on the farm. John, good morning.
Yeah, my father immigrated from Italy and landed at Victoria Dock on the 31st of August, 1939. And my grandfather, who was already out here, sponsored him. And they moved to Kyneton. Dad always used to say how he made sure that he was in by 6 o'clock every night, and he didn't give the authorities any excuse to throw him into an internment camp. He was there as a market gardener, and at one stage before the end of the war, he was actually called up in the Australian Army because he'd been naturalised through my grandfather, and he thought he was going to get away from the place for a while, but when he went to get his papers signed for application to join the Australian Army, the local policeman said to him, "You're not going anywhere, you're an essential service," because of his being the market gardener.
John, there's a couple of things there. Firstly, Peter, what happened if people were serving but were also Italian?
It would have been unlikely that they were serving in the first place. But there were people who had been interned and who were... They wanted to prove their loyalty, and one way to try to prove their loyalty was to join the armed forces. The Australian Army did have a so-called employment battalion, and it was open to people in that situation.
The other thing is...
By and large, the Australians were then keen to use that labour where they were able to. So in all sorts of different circumstances and ways, internees, POWs were used for labour. There was a much greater likelihood that that would apply to Italians. There was a great reluctance to use German labour. There was a greater suspicion that Germans might be up to no good, might attempt to escape them. The same goes for Japanese, a very great reluctance to use Japanese POW labour in particular. They just didn't do that.
What was the... because the other thing that comes out of that story is people being hidden. Was that another thing that happened? Were people being hidden from authorities to keep them out of camps?
Yes, there was that fear because the act of detaining them didn't necessarily occur at the outbreak of war. So it could be that as the war evolved, and this had been the case in the First World War, more and more people were put into camps. So there was, without doubt, that fear within the communities that the net would be cast ever more broadly as the war went on. In the case of the German community, of course, Germany was at war again from September 39, and the Australian authorities moved very quickly to make certain suspected Nazi sympathisers internees, hoping that would intimidate the rest of the community. So they didn't necessarily want to intern everyone who might be interned, but they wanted to send some messages. So no doubt that kind of fear reverberated through the community. And then with the Italians, Italy came into the war in June of 1940, and a lot were still allowed to live fairly normal lives. For a lot of Italians, the difference came after Japan entered the war at the end of 1941. So a lot of those arrests took place in 1942, and one of the target groups was the Italian community of North Queensland. So around Innisfail there were lots of Italians, and quite a high proportion of them were interned, the fear being that there could be a Japanese invasion, and then there could be a collaboration between invading Japanese forces and Italians living in that part of the world. So the internment rate was quite high in North Queensland, whereas in Victoria it was relatively low.
Peter, that's an interesting point in itself. What was the general community's feeling about internment camps and the people that were within them? Or did it vary, as you're pointing out, from state to state?
It varies from state to state, but you know, even within the state, there are different views. There are those people who take an attitude that all so-called enemy aliens should be interned, where there are others who know these people and know them in so many cases to be loyal Australians and no threat, and who argue that there shouldn't be any blanket internment, and we shouldn't be suspicious. We shouldn't play that card too firmly, because it's the sort of thing that can potentially ruin lives, and what's the benefit in locking people away, people who could otherwise be perfectly productive forces during a time when labour is low. So there's a range of views in all parts of society about, you know, what's the right level of internment to apply.
Some things don't change, do they? Anne, good morning.
Well, my father was camp commandant of number 2 internment camp at Tura during the war. And we stayed on the farm, and my sisters ran the farm while he was away. We used to go over and have lunch with him on a Sunday at the camp, and found it quite interesting because I was only about 12, 13 then. And yes, I remember all about the prisoners of war, Italian. He had Italian and German, and they used to go out on the camp, on the farms around and work, some of them. And they went back to their original country, and quite a few of them, because they met girls from the farms, came back to Australia and married them and lived quite good lives in Australia afterwards.
And what was it, what was your father before he became in charge of one of the camps?
Well, he had a First World War record of...
So as a soldier?
Yes, and came there. But then he was a soldier settler at Pyramid Hill on a farm.
Hmm.
And then was and he put himself forward for service, and because of his age, he wasn't allowed to go overseas. So he went, and he was at Durrangile Number One Camp in the first place, and then was promoted to head of Number Two Camp.
And thank you. I just want to go back to Peter, because that's the other side of this, Peter, is that you have to have people to run the camps as well.
Yeah, that's right. They needed thousands of men, and lots of them were in that category that Anne mentions there. They were people who had served very commonly in the First World War. Commonly, too, in the Second World War, they were men who had served overseas in that war but had come back to Australia and were given that kind of role to play. They might have been injured, wounded in some place overseas and came back and continued to serve in the Australian Army in that capacity. Often they were living very close to the camps themselves. Anne mentions Durrangile there. I wasn't sure myself of the pronunciation of that. That was a camp that was in a mansion in country Victoria, which for a time had been for civilian internees, but then it became the officers' camp for Germans. And then nearby, there was quite a cluster of camps around that area. There were internment, but also POW camps. And it was the POWs, there were Germans and Italians in good number in those areas, that good numbers of internees and then good numbers also of German and Italian POWs. And it was those POWs who, at the end of the war, had to be sent back to Europe, whether they wanted to remain in Australia or not. Whereas the civilian internees, a lot of them had lived in Australia before the war, and generally they were permitted after the war to remain in the country. But there were also civilians had been brought to Australia from all sorts of places. There were Germans and Italians from Palestine, for example, who were brought to Australia. And commonly they were sent back at the end of the war, but not in all cases.
I've got a text here that asks if there were any Jewish Germans interned in Australia as well.
There were. The most famous case is that of a ship called the Danira that came to Australia in 1940, and on board the Danira there were large numbers, I think up to a couple of thousand German Jewish refugees. They were people who had moved to the UK, and then in the middle of 1940, in the military crisis then, when it wasn't at all clear whether Britain could survive, Churchill adopted what he called the collar the lot policy, where German nationals were rounded up, so whether they were Jewish or Gentile, they were rounded up and placed in internment camps, and in this particular instance they were sent in large numbers for safekeeping to the other side of the world. eventually they recognised that probably they were going too far in that case. There was no genuine risk attached to these German-Jewish refugees, and eventually in Australia they were recategorised as refugee aliens, and generally then were released from internment, and some of them returned to the UK even during the war, but lots of others stayed in Australia and went on to make fabulous contributions to Australian life, despite those inauspicious beginnings to their time here.
Sid, good morning.
I have a sort of different sort of internment warrant in migrant hostels. We got off the ship for the Ranchies at in 1951, and went straight up to Kelso, Bathurst for an internment, for a reception camp. Then we went to Cabramatta reception camp, or a hostel. Then we went to Bankstown number one. Then we went to Bankstown number two. Then we went to Hargrave Park at Warwick Farm, and this sort of was in the Nissen huts.
Yep.
It had no fences, but it was just similar to the theme of being sort of stuck in one place.
Yeah, it's a similar thing. And Peter, we've been talking about internment camps. There are also labour camps. There are all sorts of different types of camps as well.
Yeah, there is certainly a continuity there. By that time, of course, the context is different. Those camps aren't related to security. It's more a matter of finding efficient ways to accommodate post-war immigrants to Australia.
Did they use any of the old camps that were used for internment for that process? Yes,
I think they did, and to the extent also of replicating the kind of accommodation. So I think the accommodation there was in the same austere style as the internment camps during the war. The reference there was to the frustration of living in those sorts of conditions, not just because they were austere, but I think for a lot of the people there was a good deal of frustration because of the long periods spent doing not much and not knowing exactly when things were going to change. That was the fate of the internee in particular, is that in wartime you don't know how long you're going to be required to live in those sorts of circumstances.
Peter, one of the things that I wonder is, when there are people that have been interned, was there then a degree of research done to find out if any of the people that were there were in fact dangerous?
Yeah, you could certainly say in the case of the POW, so those men who'd been captured in battle, that there was a certain danger there, in that many of them would have probably felt an obligation to try to escape, and had they escaped, their duty would have been to try to return to battle. So for POWs as opposed to civilian internees, certainly you can understand why there was a strong desire to detain them, to not allow them to escape. With the civilians, that's more problematic. But there would have been some among them who were potentially dangerous, whose sympathies didn't lie with Australia but with their home countries. And certainly in the period between the two world wars, the Australian security authorities were watching communities closely, but in particular the German community, and it's no doubt that there were some, a small but vociferous minority, whose sympathies were very much with Germany, and they were the sorts of people who were most likely to be swept up once the commencement of war was announced.
Helen, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Trevor, and good morning, Peter.
Hi, Helen.
I'm wondering about the cemeteries where these people finally were laid to rest, but didn't who died while they were interred. And I know of one at Murchison that's separate, at the Murchison Cemetery. There's a war cemetery. But what about other places in Australia?
Peter?
Yes, there are cemeteries where civilian internees were buried, because some of the people interned were elderly. That certainly goes for the Japanese population, where it does seem a very odd thing, and a level of security that to us might seem completely appropriate. But there were, among the Japanese who died, a number of elderly people in the Italian population as well. There were those who died. And so there are cemeteries adjacent to those internment camps, and indeed POW camps as well. So there were some who came here, who were brought here, who spent their final days in Australia. It's a very sad story that that was how they ended their lives. There is, of course, then the case of the Japanese POWs at Cowra, and in that case there was quite a large-scale loss of life because of the Cowra outbreak, and so 234, I think, Japanese POWs lost their lives at the time of the Cowra outbreak, and were buried in Australia. So, yes, there are these cemeteries that record this sad piece of history.
Actually, Gloria wants to talk about Cowra. Good morning, Gloria.
Good morning. A good friend of mine who died just recently, he was the sergeant in charge of the one of the camps at Cowra. He was actually on duty the night that the Japanese did their breakout. He reckons it was horrendous the next day when they found all the bodies are everywhere. They were stuck on barbed wire and all sorts of things. They just committed harikari. But they've got a beautiful Japanese cemetery in Cowra, down in Cowra. And it's open 7 days a week down there. It is really, really nice. And they have a lot of memorial services down there also.
Thank you. Peter, how significant was the Cowra breakout?
Yeah, it's significant, I suppose, because of the large number of deaths there. It tells us, too, something about the mentality of the Japanese POWs, because in Japanese military culture, there was a huge stigma attached to being captured in the first place. The idea was that rather than be captured on the field of battle, you would give your life for the emperor. And so a lot of the Japanese who were captured in circumstances completely beyond their control lived in shame about this fact that they had been captured. They didn't want their families back home to know. Sometimes they would give other names so it wasn't revealed back home what had happened to them. And that, I think, is what informs their decision then to attempt this breakout, is to overcome the shame of captivity. I think it's true there's a certain stigma with other nationalities as well, with the Italians and the Germans, or for that matter with Australians being captured overseas. There's a stigma that was attached to being a prisoner of war. But it was especially pronounced in the case of the Japanese, and led them to make this very fateful decision to try to break out. And where it failed in lots of cases, even from the beginning of the breakout, there were many who committed suicide. That's absolutely true.
Phil, good morning.
My grandfather took in three or four families where the husband was taken away to internment camps down in Cowra or Hay, I think it was. And he escaped himself, because he actually went to the magistrate in City Hall in Brisbane. He was a fisherman. And they let him go, but they took the other three or four guys back down to internment camps, left their families with him. And he looked after them during the whole war.
Phil, I've got to go because the news is coming up. But this is a really interesting point, Peter, because there are families of men that are then taken away. And then how do those families survive?
Yeah, that applies in both world wars. And there's a lot of touching correspondence in the National Archives, because families are broken up. In the First World War, by and large, those families had to make do. If they could prove a hardship case, they were given some financial support from the government. In the Second World War, in some cases, it was possible for those family members to join the menfolk in internment camps. So that's a more common story in the Second World War, and the authorities allowed that to happen. There were certain compounds in the camps which were labelled family camps or family compounds. But that was one of the less savoury aspects of the camp system, was that many people found themselves in those circumstances where families were separated and for very lengthy periods.
Peter, when you take a look at the life on the camp, how much time was able to be spent on the camp? Were there doctors? Were there all the facilities that were needed? Were they on camps, or did they have to spend time within the communities around them as well?
Typically, the camps in the Second World War, they were built in country areas. So there's been mention of the one at Tatura. There was one at Loveday in South Australia. And so they were close enough to small regional towns that those services were available there. In some cases, it was internees themselves who could provide services. There's in the book a mention of one of the De Niro boys, actually, who was a dentist and provided dental services, often with instruments that he himself had fashioned in the camp. So there was a combination there of the internees providing services for themselves, looking after themselves, largely regulating their own compounds. That on the one hand, and then access to those sorts of services which the Australian authorities were obliged to provide for them, and in many cases typically coming from nearby centres of population.
So, but it's also an involvement in the town as well, because we know that, like in Tatura, there's a very big Italian community. So a lot that those people just became parts of the community as well.
Yeah, so I mean, typically in internment camps, the POW1s, they had that contact outside the barbed wire, but otherwise lived their lives in the barbed wire. In the First World War, in the case of Berrima, there was a lot of interaction between the local community and the internees. So it could vary from place to place. And the surprising thing, I think, is that where you have that contact outside the camp, the people in the surrounding area, the people with whom the internees come in contact, realise that actually these are just human beings like everyone else. And
which is such a good point for us to finish with. Peter, I've got to go because the news is coming up. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.